one little announcement that I also needed to make that I guess I neglected at the beginning. We will be having our church formal dinner on the 23rd, Friday. So I guess if you haven't seen Lisa, to pay up, see her, and look forward to meeting all of you then, seeing all of you Friday up at the Raleigh City Club. It'll be a great night out and wonderful food, wonderful atmosphere, and even better environment for fellowship. The fellowship we'll have will be wonderful. So if you can join us, please do so. You're all invited. All right, you should have your Bibles in hand today, this morning. We've been looking at the passage behind us in Romans 8, 26 and 27. The issue that we've now brought into the focus, the forefront, once we've understood why prayer is the necessary thing that it is in the first place, the second, to me anyway, major thing that jumps off the page that's to be assumed that we know is what it means in that expression, "He that searcheth the hearts," what the searching of the heart is all about in connection with our sonship life. I said at the end of our last lesson that we would take a look at some verses, so if you would, take your Bibles and turn with me to Matthew chapter 6. I want to run some verses that are going to give you what I think is the kind of understanding and appreciation you're supposed to have so that you can answer the question, the one we're after now, is why does our Father want to search our hearts in the first place? What is it that He gets out of it? What is it that His part is in it, and why He wants to do that? I think that's fundamental before we talk about any mechanics of how it takes place. I think it's far more logical to know why it takes place before you start talking about how it takes place. Now, the only reason I come to this passage isn't really to point out anything that we need to know about the searching of the heart. I just wanted to come to a passage that is most often the text that is taught whenever prayer gets taught. I'm not saying that you can't learn some things about prayer here, but this is what is most commonly appealed to, and to just point up again the kind of problems that arise in most people's thinking when all you get is kind of the way in which systematic or categorical doctrine looks at prayer. You take verses and you either alter them either in word or in context to fit your preconceived notion or what you spent a whole lot of money for as a pastor. When you went through school and you got your education, you paid a lot of money to get this. So come to, pardon the expression, hell or high water, I'm going to use this as my template and my framework, and I'll find verses and make them fit. And that's usually what's done. And this is a passage that's often referred to. Now, we could spend a lot of time on this. I'm just going to do one of these. We could go to passages, for instance, that talk about wherever two or three are gathered together. If two or three agree together concerning and touching on any one thing, then I'll do it. You know, and you got passages in the Gospels where Jesus says, you ask for anything and your Father will give it to you. So the health and wealth nutcases that are running around today, and by the way, they are very healthy and very wealthy. There's no doubt about it. But if you want to make money in this world, and I mean to be able to have it hedged against financial difficulties in the country, start your own religion. The goofier, crazier, wackier it is, the better. You'll never lack for an audience. Or take the Bible and just screw it up every way you possibly can. Teach passages to mean anything, any whim you think they mean. I heard a guy doing it today. Some guy named Ed Young or something. He took a passage out of Paul, the issue of reconciliation, having the ministry of reconciliation, and taught marriage on it. So that's the way two people who are having trouble should be reconciled together. That's nowhere near that passage. But who cares? That's the way the Bible's handled today. If I can find words in it that kind of go along with what I want to say anyway, who cares what it means? This is one of those passages that often leaches into people's thinking about prayer. Now, in this passage, in this text, Jesus is teaching his disciples how to pray. But remember, Jesus is teaching them how to pray in his program, which is not our program. When Jesus is teaching this in the book of Matthew, he is in the fourth installment of Israel's fifth course of punishment. The dispensation that you and I are in today hasn't even begun. He is teaching his disciples about things that they're going to have to go through the Lord's day of wrath that they are now is impending upon them. Now, without going into all of this and wasting a lot of time on it, I'm going to have to shortcut a lot of things. Just come down to a passage that I really wanted to point out. Jesus goes along, and again, he is going through his ministry by stripping away and unveiling and uncloaking the vain religious system for the hypocrites that they are. And this is one of the things they do. When he talks about don't pray standing in the synagogues there in verse 5, and don't pray these long-winded, repetitious prayers like the vain religious leaders of Israel do. Someone was saying this the other day. I always liked, I think it was Harry Ironside or D.L. Moody, I can't remember which one they said. They said, wherever there's a man praying a long prayer, there's somebody else praying, he'll shut up. And that's about the way I feel about it too. But the fact is, he talks about them doing a lot of things here. Let's just get down, pick it up at verse 7. He says, but when you pray, use not vain repetitions as the heathen do, for they think that they shall be heard for their much speaking. Be not ye therefore like unto them, for your Father knoweth what things ye have need of before ye ask him. You ever heard somebody say that? That verse, verse 8, is the one I was after. Your Father knoweth what things you have need of before you ask him. Why does he know that? Why do you think that verse, let's put it this way, because you're going to want to answer this correctly. I want you to answer it the way most Christians view that verse. Yeah. He knows what you have need of before you ask, because he's omniscient. That's not what that's saying. In fact, I can do that same thing with my sons and my daughter, and I'm not omniscient. But there are times when I can know what they're going to need and what they're going to ask me for before they ever ask it. If I've done my role as a father properly, I'll know what that is, even as a natural, non-God, unomniscient human being. I can know that. Well, again, this goes on then with what is vainly repeated, and I mean that, vainly repeated, in most churches every Sunday, what is commonly called the Lord's Prayer, beginning there in verse 9, and it runs on down through verse 13. We're not going to go through it or anything. Jesus, by the way, never prayed that prayer. And that prayer, by the way, cannot be answered by God or even entertained by our Father today. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done. If you're praying that, you are praying as you would be under the law for something that your Father isn't even thinking about or concerned with doing today. He's not thinking about, nor is he concerned with his kingdom coming on this earth right now. That's something he will begin thinking about again once this dispensation ends and he takes the church, the body of Christ, off of this earth at the rapture. But until then, his thoughts are all concerning the heavenly places and the education and training and vocational training of his sons to be put into there and to liberate that creature from its bondage of corruption. That's what he's occupied with now. All right? I'm just saying I'm just pointing out to you that that's probably one of the most commonly appealed to passages when prayer is taught, and unfortunately so. Let's start at the beginning. Come back to 1 Chronicles. Probably we'll hear some pages go Well, not if you got a Bible from me. People who usually get Bibles from me, I break them in for you. But I'm not going to do that anymore. It takes too much time. Come back to 1 Chronicles chapter 28. Here's a book I doubt you've spent a lot of time in. Unless you want to go to sleep. If you want to get some good sleep, if you have a problem getting to sleep, pick up the Chronicles and start reading them. That'll snap those little baby blues shut so quick. I'm not saying it's dull to me, but I'm saying in most people's cases, especially when you get to some of the beget passages, run through some of those lineages, those genealogies, boy, that'll snap your eyes shut. Anyway, by the way, there's very vital reasons for all of those things. Come down to chapter 28. What I want to do is, this is the first time that the searching of the heart gets mentioned. Chapter 28, and of course, when you're in the Chronicles and the Kings, who are you? Who basically is all that information about? When you're in the Chronicles and the King, First and Second Kings, First and Second Chronicles, who's this all about? Well, Israel, yeah, but I mean the characters, main characters, who? David and Solomon. David and Solomon. And by the way, the Bible isn't just put together randomly where you have Kings comes along and then Chronicles comes along and almost is a repetition of the Kings. That's not the way that's meant. One of those views the information of Israel's program at that time from man's perspective. The other is the view of it from God's perspective. But when it comes to this, Solomon is in view here. And I want you to come down and look at this. Pick it up at, oh boy. Well, again, time's sake, what should I cut out of this? Well, let's pick it up at verse 2 here in chapter 28. It says, "Then David the king stood up upon his feet." Now they're at a place. David wants to build God a temple. He wants to build the temple. God comes along and tells David, "You can't." And he tells David why in this passage. And David gets everything ready for it, and then it falls to Solomon to build it. It says, and so that's kind of the context of what we're breaking in on. "David stood upon his feet and said, 'Hear me, my brethren and my people. As for me, I had in mine heart to build an house of rest for the ark of the covenant of the Lord and for the footstool of our God and made ready for the building.'" See, he made it all ready. "But God said unto me, 'Thou shalt not build an house for my name, because thou hast been a man of war.'" See, Solomon is going to be a man of peace. God has those two men to show the, actually two aspects that are going to be taking place in really the life of the Lord Jesus Christ himself. He's going to come back as a man of war, then he's going to reign as the man of peace. But David, it doesn't fall to David, it falls to Solomon because Solomon is the man of peace. David was a man of war and has shed blood. Howbeit, verse 4, "The Lord God of Israel chose me before all the house of my father to be king over Israel forever. For he hath chosen," and by the way, that's going to be literally true. When Jesus Christ reigns on David's throne, he is from the direct bloodline of David. "To be the ruler and of the house of Judah, the house of my father, among the sons of my father, to make me king over all of Israel. And all of my sons, for the Lord hath given me many sons, of all my sons he hath chosen Solomon, my son, to sit upon the throne of Israel of the Lord over kingdom of the Lord over Israel. And he said unto me, Solomon thy son, he shall build my house and my courts, for I have chosen him to be my son." Remember how when we went over that in the table of contents of the book of Proverbs, I told you that David, I don't even know if I've still got that on here. Yeah, in that interlude that takes place, David is raised up, but Solomon, when God says, "I will be to him a father and he will be to me a son," he's talking to about Solomon. He's talking to David about Solomon. And he has chosen Solomon and again, him to be my son and I will be his father. There's how I'm going to deal with him. This is a preview of coming attractions in Israel's program to when the remnant is going to actually be God's sons and function and operate just as God wanted to do with David and Solomon. And it's that real, true father-son relationship. I will be to him a father, and he will be to me a son. Or as it says here, "I have chosen him to be my son, and I will be his father. Moreover, I will establish his kingdom forever. If he be constant to do my commandments and my judgments as at this day, Now, therefore, in the sight of all Israel, the congregation of the Lord, and in the audience of our God, keep and seek for all the commandments of the Lord your God, that ye may possess this good land, and leave it for an inheritance for your children after you forever. Look at verse 9. And thou, Solomon, my son, he's already established, he's oriented him, as he's going to adopt him, he's oriented him, I'm going to be not God to creature, but father to son. Now he addresses, thou, Solomon, my son, know thou the God of thy father. David is instructing Solomon, and serve him with a perfect heart and a willing mind. Boy, is that encapsulates sonship. There are sonship perfections that take place at each component of sonship edification. There's a goal to it. There's an aim. There's an objective, and it can be measured. Once it's measured, you can say, I have that perfected. I've got a perfect attitude. I've got this perfected, that perfected, with each goal and each aim and each attainment that can be measured, it's perfected. And when you want to encapsulate that, what a great way to encapsulate it. He has a perfect heart. Serve him with a perfect heart and a willing mind. That's the attitude of a son. Encapsulated. The willingness of the mind to do it. For the Lord searcheth all hearts and understandeth all the imaginations of the thoughts. If thou seek him, he will be found of thee. But if thou forsake him, he will cast thee off forever. And there's more to this, some really great stuff all the way down, actually, through the chapter. But there in verse 9 especially, and you could go on down really through verse 19. There's some great stuff all down through there. But anyway, what I'm after especially is that you see in verse 9, there's the first use of the searching of the heart, and it's in connection with a son. And by the way, Solomon knew what that was. For the Lord searcheth all hearts, all his, and understandeth the imaginations of the thoughts, and this is in the context of his sons. We're going to skip the 139th Psalm for now, and we'll come back to it. Now we know, come over to Jeremiah chapter 17. I want you to see a passage that you probably have memorized. We know that sonship edification entails the Spirit of God doing a whole bunch of things to our human spirit. And there's a passage that makes that issue the issue when it comes to the Spirit of God doing a bunch of things to our human spirit. Does anybody, by the way, it's not this one, but does anybody know what I'm talking about? When we have a passage that we were told about, we went over this several times, where you're notified that now the Spirit of God is going to do a bunch of things to my human spirit. The inner man becomes the whole issue. It's in Jeremiah, the New Covenant, Jeremiah 31. I want to go there, but before we do, I want to stop off here at Jeremiah 17. It's a very familiar passage, and I want to point something out here that I think is going to be important as you study the Bible on your own. Come down and look at verse 9. Which is the passage you probably have memorized. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? But look at the next verse. I, the Lord, search the heart. I try the reins even to give every man according to his ways and according to the fruit of his doings. Now, what he's talking about here is really evil men. He's talking about the heart that is deceitful and desperately wicked. Above all things. What man? Who can know it? What man can know it? No man can know it. But in the very next verse, he says, I know it. I, the Lord, trieth the heart, or search the heart. I try the reins. The reason I'm going to this passage is that's not talking about sonship. The reason I want to point that out is to say that not every time that you're going to come across the issue of God knowing the heart or trying the heart or even searching the heart, is it necessarily a reference to this intimate father-to-son function that we're talking about here this morning taking place in the father-son relationship. You've got to be careful and make sure that you keep things within their context. Because the truth is, God still is God. And when He hasn't got that relationship established with somebody, He certainly uses His omniscience and His godness. And He can know the heart. He can know that a man's heart is desperately wicked above all things when no other man can. And this isn't a reference to that intimate father-son fellowship. It refers to knowing a wicked man's heart, knowing what's really going on in it, even when the wicked can come along, as you would see if you gave this passage some time, and fool other men into thinking that they didn't have a wicked heart, which is what the vain religious system of Israel put over on the people of Israel all the time. Heavens, it got to the point where they were supposed to be shepherding the sheep. They were eating the sheep. I'm not saying that. I mean, the Bible says that. You were eating them. You were feeding off of them. Instead of feeding them, it was lamb chops. And if the searching of the heart is this, here in Jeremiah 17, that is, if God is searching the heart of His Son, is the issue of His godness, His divine X-ray beam or radar into your heart to look into the heart of every man, identify their motives, their thinking, their agenda, and so forth. And that's what Romans 8, 26 and 27 is about. If that's true, remember that passage that we just was at in Matthew 6? If it's true that God's godness, His omniscience, to go into your heart as God and know every motive, every thought, every desire, every what your agenda is, what all stands behind your thoughts and everything, if that's what He's doing, out of His godness, if that's what Matthew 6 was talking about, if that's what this passage of Jeremiah is talking about, what in the world is the point of all that? Why does the Spirit have to do anything? Why would the Spirit have to tell the Father anything? Why would He have to make intercession for us? If prayer is God in His godness knowing us omnisciently, this is a moot issue. See, these two verses kick you in the teeth if you think that your relationship as a son with your father is going to be based upon him being God and you being a creature. Because this is pointless. Because God looks right into the heart anyway. See, this is one of those things that if you point it out to a Christian, and maybe you like to have fun doing this, I don't know. Maybe you have this morbid sense of humor, or you just like catching Christians in their stupidity. But the next time somebody talks to you about God knowing your heart that way, point that out to them, because these are at loggerheads. In a Christian who thinks, I pray to God who scans me like the Homeland Security when I go through the airport, and He just scans my heart with His godness, and that's all He's doing. Just scan me, Lord, scan me. And He scans my heart. What in the world is this activity all about then? Let's take these two verses and throw them out of the Bible, because they don't even belong there. Because what this is doing, this is making God needy. God needs, if you can't ask for what you need to ask for, God now is going to have His Spirit, who knows and searches the heart, God that searches the heart, knoweth what the mind, He knows what the mind of the Spirit is. The Spirit then makes the intercession for you and asks the Father in your behalf. And the Father then can do His part and provide for it. That demands a real, not theory, a real father and a real son relationship. If he knows what your problem already is, and he knows what you should ask for, he already understands all the dilemma, he understands all of that before you ever put the thoughts together, what's the point of verse 26 and 20? There is no point if that's all it is. It renders that kind of thinking about prayer renders Romans 8, 26 and 27 pointless. If the way most folks think about God in prayer is praying to a creator God, part of his creator, and not as a son to a father, and that relationship being real, not just theory, there's really no sense or reason for the Spirit of God to intercede at all, because God already knows. Well, I mentioned the New Covenant. Let's just look at it since we're close by. Come over to the 31st chapter of Jeremiah. Jeremiah 31. These are passages you would have already come across before you ever got to Romans, that again would help build in you the frame of reference that Paul assumes that you have when he says, "And he that searcheth the hearts," you know what the searching of the heart is already. I don't think we do. That's why we're going to have to go back and get it. That's not something to be ashamed of. That's just the truth of it. That's the way I was. But here is, of course, the passage in Jeremiah 31, 31 through 34. This is the new covenant that we've gone over many times and talked about. This is not a covenant of land. It's not a covenant for a king. It's not a covenant for kingdoms. It's not a covenant for any of those things. This is a covenant that has to do with the inner man. It's a spiritual covenant that is going to provide for Israel to be able to be adopted and educated as sons themselves. And sonship is at the core of the new covenant. And come down and just look again at verse 31. He says, "Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel, with the house of Judah, not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, which my covenant they break, although I was an husband unto them, saith the Lord. But this shall be the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel. After those days, saith the Lord, I will put my law in their inward parts and write it in their hearts. And they will be, and will be their God, and they shall be my people. And they shall teach no more every man his neighbor and every man his brother, saying, Know the Lord, for they shall all know me, from the least of them unto the greatest of them, saith the Lord. For I will forgive them their iniquity, and I will remember their sin no more." The last two components are justification. The first three components are sanctification. And in the center of that, you've got, he is going to take his law, and that's not the law of Moses. He's going to take the commandments of sonship, and he's going to write those things in their heart. Now, when I said before that that's the work of the Spirit, and for now, all I want to note in this, without going into a lot of detail, there's going to be this heart writing going on, right? And who is the member of the Godhead that's responsible for that? Who? The Holy Spirit. That's right. And if we've got a problem with that, you can see that in 2 Corinthians 3:3. We don't have time to go over there right now, but if you go over to 2 Corinthians 3:3, you'll see when Paul talks about ye are the epistle of Christ, not written... written on the fleshy tables of the heart, but it's the Spirit of God who writes that. Now, in connection with this, so God, the Spirit of God, he's going to write information on the fleshy table of your heart. Is he the only one who writes on that table? Now, you know, if I'm asking that question, what the answer probably is. Your problem is, if I was to say, who else writes there? Right, that's right. We do. Come over to Proverbs chapter 3 and then chapter 7. Proverbs chapter 3. In the exhortation phase of the book of Proverbs, we don't have a lot of time to set a lot of detail here, but I just want to point out a couple of things. Let's look at verse 1. Chapter 3, verse 1. My son, forget not my law, but let thine heart keep my commandments. For length of days and long life and peace they shall add to thee. Let not mercy and truth forsake thee. Bind them about thy neck. Write them. Now there's the father, there's David, telling Solomon, his son, write them upon the table of thine heart. The son writes. One other passage along those lines. Come over to chapter 7, verse 1. My son, keep my words and lay up my commandments with thee. Keep my commandments and live. By the way, these commandments are not the Ten Commandments of the law. These are the commandments of a father who commands his son. Keep my commandments and live, and my law as the apple of thine eye. Bind them upon thy fingers. Write them upon the table of thine heart. What I'm after in this is, you're told in the New Covenant, God is going to write upon your heart His word, His curriculum, His commandments, His commands, His curriculum is going to be written there. But you also know that you as a son, you write them on your own heart. Now, that's a dual role, right? It's almost like this. If I was teaching you some things, some of you are teachers or have taught. If you've ever taught a Sunday school class or anything like that, do you just stand up there with nothing and teach? Now, I'm talking about, let's take it out of the world of the Bible totally. Does a teacher just stand up and start talking with nothing in front of her or him? What do they have? Notes. By the way, what are the notes part of? A what? A curriculum. All right, so I'm teaching you out of my notes. What do you do as a good student? You college students ought to know. Take notes. Now, who wrote my notes? I did. By the way, I told this to somebody the other day. When I was at Vandercook, at Vandercook College of Music in Chicago, our week went from Tuesday through Saturday. We were off Sunday and Monday. The reason we had Saturday class was because that's when the graduate students came in. They came in on the weekend. And they would mix them with us. I had classes with graduate students who were getting their master's degree. And it was told to us then, they said, watch an undergrad versus a graduate student. You know what the difference is, how you can tell them? I said, no. When the teacher comes in and says, good morning, class, the undergraduate says, good morning. The graduate student writes it down. Now, I'm teaching from my notes. I'm teaching from the curriculum. You're writing. Once in a while, I'm going to step down. And even at maybe while I'm lecturing, I'm going to look and see what you're writing. And I'm going to check that, and I'm going to see if you're on track. Maybe it's not word for word what I said, but you have the understanding and appreciation as you have written it for what I have been teaching you from what I've written. That's kind of what's going on here. And so therefore, you have a dual, and all I'm after in that, not that we have the analogy perfectly straight, but that you see in sonship there is a dual role. It's not just my father writing. I'm writing, and he's doing something about what I'm writing. There's the father-son duality. You and the spirit of your father are writing on your heart. I don't have a chart for this. I'm never going to make one. I don't know what a fleshy table of the heart looks like. I don't know anybody in Hollywood at CGI Graphics that could figure out what one looked like. It's not my job to figure that out. You think of it the way you want. But on the fleshy tables of your heart, that's what has to get written. And the Father's going to write, you're going to write. And hopefully what happens is, once you've written it, the Father can come along, and when He writes it, He's writing directly over what you wrote, right down the line. What you and him write, if they were two sheets of acetate, two clear transparencies, when you put them on top of one another, they would match. Now, something has to be done to see that that takes place. That's what we're after in the searching of the heart. But right now, I just wanted to impress upon you the dual role. And by the way, this puts sonship prayer in a far different dynamic than merely a passive activity. Sonship prayer isn't a passive activity or one that's only one way. No, it's two-way. It's bidirectional. Now, in connection with that father-son dynamic, we're here in the book of Proverbs. Let's look at a couple other passages. Proverbs chapter 20 is one of my favorite passages. Proverbs chapter 20 and verse 27. When God created you, He created you with a body, He created you with a soul, and He created you with a spirit, small case s, a human spirit. I used to have charts that would, well, it's kind of like our little friend here, that would make you just look like that. You would be as impressed as that guy is impressed. The whole congregation with my charts, they were so intricate. They looked like some MIT genius technician, engineer, engineered this whole chart of the human heart, the spirit, the soul, the dividing of it all up. And of course, we had to throw the heart out because we had to talk about the cardia is not really the heart that pumps blood, and it's not. But all that, and oh, we had to come up. It was. You would have looked like that. You'd have been impressed. And of all the men who had all the great degrees and all of the theological training, not one man who I ever heard in my life pointed out that what's in that heart is a candle. That's what your spirit is. Look at this verse. Come down to verse 27. This is Proverbs chapter 20, verse 27. The spirit, the small case s, that's your human spirit. The spirit of man is the candle of the Lord. What's he going to do with it? Searching all the inward parts of the belly. He's talking about your inner man. God has so constructed you with a human spirit that he can actually utilize that as a candle, and he is searching for something. That's what he's going to be doing in the searching of the heart with your spirit. Let's get this guy off here. He bugs me. But what I'm after is that's a magnificent verse that God is able to, that just points up the importance to him of the searching. He's the one doing it. This is vital to him. This is something he's got to do in order for certain things to take place. He's got to search you. In connection with this as well, come over to the 23rd chapter of Proverbs. Again, I'm cutting things way back here so we can finish up some stuff but of what I was going to say. But chapter 23, come down here to a passage where Solomon is in this father-to-son relationship, and Solomon is going to recount what his father has told him. Come down and pick it up at verse 15. Chapter 23, verse 15. My son, if thine heart be wise, my heart shall rejoice, even mine. Yea, my range shall rejoice. What's the last part of this verse? When thy lips speak right things. Again, if this whole thing is a God who scans me like a scanner in his godness, that verse makes no sense at all and is needless and pointless. Especially the last part of it. You mean to tell me this is a dual issue. It's both David and God himself. David being the stand-in for the father at this time with Solomon. He again, my son, my heart shall rejoice. If thine heart be wise. All right, how am I going to know that? How do I know if you've got a wise heart? Huh? say it. When your lips speak right things, unless you speak right things, I'm not going to know if your heart's wise or foolish. That's the core of sonship prayer. You're going to have to say things to me, and I'm not going to get into, well, should it be audibly or can I just think? But what I'm after is that you've got to express it to your Father, that you know some things, and when you speak right things, my heart shall rejoice, even mine. My reins shall rejoice. It'll make my heart, it'll make my whole emotion, the whole spectrum of my emotions rejoice. This is what I've been longing for with my son. I hear things, when I hear things coming out of his mouth, what is the Father going to do? He's going to listen for things, and until he listens, until the Son is expressing it, until that expression is an expression of what was written on his heart, when those expressions match the Father knows he can now move on. And until then, we're staying right here. And we're going to go back over it and back over it and back over it until you've got it. And if we have to approach it from different angles or do whatever we have to do, we're not moving on until you get it. And I'll know when you got it, because here's a critical issue. The Father knows what he's listening for. He knows the curriculum. He knows what the checkpoint is. He knows what he needs to hear coming out of that son's mouth. That's reflective of what's in his heart. And once that's accomplished, the Father knows he can then move on to the next thing. How is it that a natural father, believe me, if I had a business, I'm not a businessman, and I don't want to be a businessman. That just scares me skinny. But if I had a business, the way a natural father would know when his son's heart was wise was when I hear him say back to me the wisdom that I've been trying to teach him. Or I'll even hear him in a business or out on the shop floor, I'll hear him say it to other workers. He's saying what I would say to him. And I can walk away grinning from ear to ear. That's my boy. That's my son. He now has a wise heart in that area. And that describes that bidirectional communication of sonship prayer. Well, let's come over. I'm going to have to really cut this down. One of the major passages we're going to have to deal with, and we'll deal with it in detail later on. But for now, let's come to the passage I skipped and at least note one thing about it today. Come over to the 139th Psalm. I mentioned to you there was a chapter in the Bible dedicated to the searching of the heart. This is it. The 139th Psalm. All I want to do this morning is to draw to a close, and I don't want to get too far afield, of our question of why the Father wants to search the Son's heart to begin with. Why does He want to do that? Well, the verses we've gone over and some of the lines of thought we put out there today should be starting to get you going along that line, and the train's moving in the right direction. This is a fascinating psalm. It's not only fascinating for me because of what it's about, but it's a fascinating psalm to the degree that most people who read this or teach this teach it 180 degrees out of phase of what it's about. Let's just get a little flavor for it. Let's read the beginning of it. In verse 1, by the way, if you have a Bible that has the little inscriptions above the psalm, this is to the chief musician, a psalm of David. This is David writing. Now, we know we could go into a lot of things here about it's the 139th psalm. It's in the fifth book of Psalms. The fifth book of Psalms is talking about the king or the blesser and his blessings and all this kind of thing. But for now, let's just cut to the chase of some things we want to get to. He says, O Lord, thou hast searched me and known me. Thou knowest my downsitting and mine uprising. Thou understandest my thought afar off. Thou compassest my path and my lying down, and art acquainted with all my ways. For there is not a word in my tongue, but lo, O Lord, thou knowest it altogether. Thou hast beset me behind and before, and laid thine hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high, I cannot attain unto it. Well, I'd like to read this whole thing, and we will read the whole thing eventually. But when you listen to that, most people at first blanch, when they read that, they think this is all this is doing is talking about God's omniscience. That everything David talks about here is God scanning him. After all, he's known me. He's searched me, known me. He knows when I go to sit down, when I go to bed. He knows when I get up. He understands my thought afar off. But you have to ask yourself the question, why does he know that? What causes God to know that? David tells you in there. Yeah, verse 3. And art acquainted with, or pardon me, where was it? Verse 4. There is not a word in my tongue. David did what we would call today, he chatted up the Lord. David exhausted his vocabulary with his father. There wasn't a thing that David thought that he didn't make a conversation between him and his father. His father knew his whole repertoire, his whole vocabulary. He knew every thought he had because David would express them to him all the time. And we're going to prove this with more than just what I'm saying here, but if my understanding's correct, and I believe it is, there isn't one thing in what I just read that has anything to do with God's omniscience and him just in godness scanning David's heart like a beam. This has come directly out of the father to son, two-way, bidirectional communication in sonship prayer. David had a prayer life that no believer today almost would even recognize, because he didn't just talk to God about the problems he was having. But the bulk of his concentration with his father was on how he was having in his heart God's word written there and the searching of his heart taking place. David knows exactly what that searching is. Now there's a lot of other wonderful details here, but come down to the end of it. I want you to see the last two verses of the psalm. And I'm going to tell you right up front, my understanding is this is not talking about the same thing he started with. This is a different thing altogether than what he started with. By the way, when David talks about he knows his downsetting, his uprising, compassed his path, and is lying down, or acquainted with all, what is he going over there? When you go to bed and get up, it's your day. He's going over his day with him. But when he comes down, actually there's something that takes place in verse 19. If you read this psalm, look for the shift that takes place at verse 19. David isn't talking about his day anymore. When he says in verse 19, "Surely thou wilt slay the wicked, O God. Depart from me, therefore, ye bloody men, for they speak against thee wickedly, and thine enemies take thy name in vain. Do not I hate them, O Lord, that hate thee? Am I not grieved with those that rise up against me? I hate them with perfect hatred. I count them mine enemies." There's a dramatic shift that takes place in verse 19. He's not talking so much anymore about what he has done in his day. What's he going to do now? He's going to start talking to the Lord about what's going to be in his day tomorrow. There's a course of action he's going to take with his enemies that are mutual enemies between him and his Lord. And in connection with what he's going to do tomorrow that he hasn't done yet, look at the last two verses. "Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts." And he gives you the reason why. This is why. "And see if there be any wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting." That's why. All I want to bring out right now is that when David ends that psalm, he ends it by asking God. He initiates it. God doesn't do it automatically. He will only do this when you ask him to. God searches David's heart. And the whole reason why David asks for that is because he knew it was vital. And the whole reason why he knew it was vital is because he knew what God his Father thought about it. What his Father thought about searching his heart. David derived his perception of not ending his session with his until he had asked him to search his heart, because he perceived the vital nature of his heart being searched by his Father, because David could answer the question why his Father wanted to do it in the first place. And he actually does answer it for us. And once again, that brings us back to that original question. Why does God want to search our hearts to begin with? And really, the reason is the exact same reason a natural father would search his natural son's heart. It comes from that first orientation concept. I am going to be to you a father, and you are going to be to me a son. This bidirectional back and forth interchange. And the interchange isn't theory, it's real, and it's vital, and it's necessary, and it makes these two verses make sense of Romans 8, 26 and 27. And given the passages we've looked at, especially this one, Psalm 139, in fact, the Psalm 139, 23 and 24 passage, we can actually from these passages have our question answered, as well as the Proverbs 2:3 passage, the interactive learning, if you cry after knowledge and lift up your voice, that's you doing the talking. And finally that Proverbs 23:15 through 16 passages, my son, if thine heart be wise, my heart shall rejoice, even mine. Yea, my reign shall rejoice when thy lips speak right things. And David understood, I want you to search my heart. Why? To see if there be any wicked way in me and lead me in the way everlasting. The reason why, I'm going to go through this slow, and this will be the end of it, just to tie everything up. The reason why a father searches his son's heart is just as a natural father would want his son to come along with him at some time and knock on his door and sit down with him and have some communication with him, that the son has initiated himself for the express purpose of coming along and saying, I want to see if I've got this right. I don't have time to probe you or anything, and you probably don't want to be probed right now, but what I'm after is when you see David express, after the colon of verse 23 and verse 24, see if there be any wicked way in me, and don't think about the details of what that's saying. Think about what the Father is doing. What's he doing? Right. Seeing if he knows the way of the Father. You said seeing if he knows it. That's the fundamental thing I'm after. What's another way of talking about seeing if he knows it? Perceiving, being aware. But I'm talking about the Father, what the Father's doing. Searching. Well, what I'm after is he's making an assessment. That's what he's doing. David says, search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts. Why? Father, you and I are going to have to communicate with one another. I have perceived on my own from your curriculum what I'm to do. Now, this is my course. I'm going to do A, B, and C. Now, I'm going to sit down with you, and I want you to search this, and I want you to assess and evaluate and judge and determine, am I right? Or is there any wicked way in this? The express purpose that the Son initiates or searched is to enable His Father to make an assessment of Him, to give His Father the opportunity to assess how well He's learning. I know you've all said this a little bit today, and you've all been right, but what I'm trying to do, I'm trying to split hairs here. I'm trying to get you to appreciate it's the fundamental issue that you need to appreciate isn't just that the Father's going to hear or see what's going on and if it's going on okay and everything, but it gives Him, it gives the Father, it enables Him to do it. The fundamental issue in the searching of the heart is what it does for the Father. It gives Him the opportunity to assess your heart that He would never be able to have the opportunity to do if you didn't ask Him to. Do you see that? That's what I'm after. It's simple. But it needs to be first understood. And that's what a father's doing when in response to his son coming to him and initiating the activity, the father's response is going to be to listen to what his son is saying, and on the basis of the father himself knowing himself what to listen for, on the basis of that, what the of knowing himself, what the effectual working that he taught his son is supposed to do, he listens to what his son says, and in doing so, he searches his son's heart based upon what he says to him, and he evaluates the measure of the effectual working of what his son has learned based upon what his son says to him. Now, that puts the father in a position to be able to judge how next to deal with his son in connection with making further progress. If this is a true thing, and if our father really is to us a father and we're really to him a son, we have to be able to provide him the means and the opportunity to judge us and to evaluate us and to assess us on how next to deal with us in connection with making progress, not only in the advancement in the curriculum, but how to deal with his son when it comes to making sure his son can gain and make full use out of the information he's been given and the learning that he's to acquire from that information to put it all into practice in the details of his life. Now, if we boiled all that down that I just said, let's get it simple. A father wants to search his son's heart so that he can ensure for his son. The father's going to do something for me in that. He's going to ensure for me that the full effectual working of what he's being taught can be attained and utilized and to be the profit and benefit to his son that it should be. And that's the exact way it is between God our Father and us. Now that doesn't describe what he does when he searches our heart. That doesn't describe any of the mechanics, but it describes why it takes place in the first place. A judging, evaluation, assessing, and ensuring is going on. And the father gets, that's what the father gets out of it. Put yourself in the role of a father, if you can. You don't want your son just going through life. You want to periodically evaluate, judge, assess, is he properly functioning? So that takes time for us to sit down and communicate. And by what comes out of his mouth, I'll know how to proceed with him. But sonship prayer and the searching of the heart provides first and foremost the father to be able to assess and assure that his son's progress is effectual. And that's on the part of the father in the searching of the son's heart. it gives him the opportunity to judge, evaluate, assess, and assure it's all going on. Well, we'll stop right there, but you should now have an understanding of why prayer takes place in the should happen in the first place. Without it, it's indispensable, because I won't come to the knowledge of God without it. And secondly, when it comes to the searching of the heart, I know why my Father wants to do it to begin with. It's the only way he'll ever be able to evaluate and judge and assess what I'm about to do with the information he's just given me. And he wants to make sure that that's there before you make a decision that's critical in your life or in the life of someone else. That's what David was about to do. He was about to go out and kill some folks. I hate them with perfect hatred. I'm going to take this and this course of action. Now search my heart, Father, and see if there's any wicked way in that. You judge it. You assess it. You evaluate it. And then by what else we're going to talk about in the mechanics of it, he'll make that known that there's trouble there, or he'll make that known, green light. Go right ahead and do what you're doing. It's godly in every way. So we'll talk about that more later on. So we'll stop right there.